All right, well, thanks for coming. I'm actually impressed at this large turnout given the time of day. So I'm going to be talking about our proposed research, and we titled this Star Formation Taste Test. So the title stems from an analogy between our proposed research and a way in which a cook would attempt to recreate a dish she saw on a menu. So this is research that's part of the complete survey. Many of the members are listed here, but we also hope to have larger collaborations with many of you all. So let me begin by explaining this analogy. When a cook attempts to recreate a dish, he or she would use her knowledge of food chemistry and all the available equipment to cook up the dish. And that would be analogous to simulators and theorists attempting to explain observational regions using simulations and analytical ideas. So many times, simulators would directly compare their simulations to observations, similarly with the analytical ideas. But what a cook would do is taste her dish as well as the original dish. And that's the key step that we plan on building on. So we plan on one of the main products of our proposed research is to make it easier for us to access simulations as well as the Star Formation community at large. And we will have a repository where people can easily look at other simulations and perform the taste test similar to what we are planning on doing.
Paolo has the repository.
Right, Paolo has the repository in KDAC. So the kind of observations that are on the menu you all are very familiar with. This is the Perseus molecular cloud. And as you all know, star formation is a very complicated process spanning large density regimes. So you'll notice regions of isolated star formation where a few stars will form, and regions of dense star formation where a number of stars form, or what you would call clustered star formation. So it's up to the theorists to explain these various density regimes and the various star formation processes. Now, so these are the kind of simulations that are on the menu, and it's up to the theorists to explain this. Now, in the past, there are various groups of simulators proposing various physical mechanisms that form stars. And as you know, different simulations involving different ingredients both produce stars. It's our task to kind of weed out the incorrect simulations from the correct ones. And the way we're going to do that is by requesting and encouraging simulators to share their simulation data cubes. And that will be done through the use of KDAC.
But we won't call them correct and incorrect.
No. Okay.
Realistic and
right.
Experimental.
Okay. Right, so we're going to request and encourage simulators to post their simulation data cubes on KDAC, which is the Computational Astrophysics Data Analysis Center set up by our friends at UCSD. And this website explains all about KDAC, and it's linked off the website to this workshop. So the key step in our proposed research is the tasting step. We plan on observing the simulations, quote-unquote, observing the simulations by applying radiative transfer to the simulation data cubes. This line of research has been done by Padawan, Norton, and Uvella in the past. And we are currently in the process of exploring radiative transfer codes, many of which have different features. So a few of them are named here, Radish, Moccasin, and others. We're also open to suggestions to what codes we can use for this project. So once we apply the radiative transfer, we'll have synthetic spectra of the simulation data cubes. And we can also go one step further and observe these spectra the way in which a telescope would. So we would degrade the resolution and take into consideration telescope beams, et cetera. So once we have that product, we can apply statistical tests to do the direct comparisons between the observed simulations and the true observations. So there are a number of tests that we can perform. We can look at the PDFs, the power spectra, the autocorrelation functions, etc. So many of you are familiar with a lot of these tests. I'm not going to go into any detail on most of these, but I do want to spend time on two of them.
Are these all geared toward comparison with simulations of large-scale structures like cold clouds, not geared toward individual cores?
Cores, yes. Disks, no. So in other words, like Scott's TMC1C stuff would be a yes. But the transitional disk versus other kind of disk and all that is not in the project now, but it doesn't mean that somebody, in other words, it's not what we're doing, but it doesn't machinery that we
sell. I mean, all the comparisons you have in there have to do with sort of large scale structures.
Yeah, but also, Earl didn't say this, but the radish and moccasin, those are continuum radiative transfer codes, and so there's dust modeling in this as well as the gas.
Yeah, so this project is geared towards the kind of surveys that we've heard about this week. So one of the statistical tests we can perform is CloudShine. You've all heard about this 2 days ago. So Jonathan Foster and Alyssa Goodman took deep near-infrared observations of the Perseus molecular cloud, and they found this extended emission. So they modeled this emission as the scattering of ambient starlights. So though CloudShine can be a hindrance to deriving calm density maps, it can still be used to derive the structure of the clouds because the scattering profile is also dependent on the density of the cloud. And the other statistical tests, one other statistical test we can use is through the use of dendrograms. So dendrograms is a method to map the hierarchical structure of a cloud. And in this algorithm, the peaks and the minimum of an intensity profile are taken into account to develop the structure tree. And Alyssa talked all about the differences between dendrograms and clump finds. I'm not going to get into that. But Eric Rosolowski and company also created these structure trees for the L1448 region of Perseus. And he also considered the virial parameter for many of these leaves. And the yellow leaves marks the regions that are collapsing, only considering the effect of dispersion and mass. So I know that a lot of you have questions about the way in which the virial parameter is used. Nevertheless, we can still apply this method to both simulations and other observations and make statistical comparisons between the two. And the last statistical test that I want to talk about today is synthetic observations. So this is a result of one of Paolo's simulations. And Eric Rosolowski applied noise and took synthetic spectra of this observation to map the column density structure that one would obtain from such a method. And we can also do these for a variety of simulations and compare that with observed regions of many star forming regions.
So is that one taking into account, like, telescope properties and things?
No, he just applied some noise, if I'm probably correct.
Actually, Paolo gave him the spectra. So the column density is from the simulation, the spectra from the simulation. But then what he did was to take the sampling pattern of FCRO and the noise from FCRO and produce the thing that you see in the middle.
That's a model of what would be observed.
Yes, this is right.
And I don't know whether Rubble's going to show, but then we did all these statistical comparisons, and Paolo's like way too much self-gravitating stuff in the simulation. It's too strong for it to match that particular.
Was it the simulation with or without self-gravity?
Without.
Without.
but apparently it would be a lot of.
You just
All right, so just to recap, we encourage, a lot of you have a lot of expertise in both simulations and observations, and we just want to make a systematic effort to compare people's simulations with the kind of observation we discussed this week. So our main product, as I said before, was to make this step much easier. We're going to traverse this triangle a number of times in the next couple years, and we can certainly use your expertise and your guidance to make this easier for everyone to compare simulations and observations. And if you were interested, one place to start would be to go to this Taste Testing Basecamp website. I believe it's linked off the website to this conference. And from Alyssa's email, I'm supposed to show you briefly how to navigate this. So for those of you who have used wiki-like pages, it's very similar. So it's basically the exact same thing. You have these tabs on the top, and you can start at the home page. There's a little description on what we're trying to do. And here are the most recent messages. You can click on Alyssa's email, I think, that you all got about this workshop. So if you'd like to post a message, you know, you would just go to messages, and I don't have wireless here, interesting.
Yeah, it's like it's not
turned on. Sorry. That should be it. Right, so like I said, this has tabs on the top of the page, very similar to wiki pages. And here we are at the messages site, so you can post messages by clicking up here, and you can look at what other people have posted. So there's also Mark Krumholtz already posted some simulations that we have access to through the use of KDAC, of course, and we encourage simulators to go on this website.
Can
and
I show one of Mark's nice whiteboards?
Yes, sure.
The whole idea of this, of doing it like this, was because when you look at a paper, it's really hard to tell sometimes exactly what the person was trying to do and exactly how they did it. And so there's a way here, that's just a bunch of things that people have uploaded that you saw on that list. And there's a way for people to just describe in English. There's a form there, but they can change it however they want, what it was that they were trying to do. So that, for example, if they were not trying to study the properties of cores, right, and somebody's trying to use their simulation to study cores, they would know not to do that. So, here, Mark, you can describe what you wrote down.
This was, I mean, so this simulation, this wasn't so much a simulation, this was really more a numerical experiment of just, suppose you put a point mass in a supersonically turbulent medium and it starts Bondi coil accreting, what's the rate of accretion from the turbulent medium? So this was, you know, so there's no sort of realistic physics in here, this is just a numerical experiment to solve that very simple problem.
And so one thing that we haven't done is we were hoping to have, and people have uploaded a lot of stuff, but so we're hoping to have it all uploaded and then figure out a good way to make it so people, so that, you know, you wanted to type in Bondi coil accretion, and then you could find all the pages that pull it down. So we may actually go away from this kind of straightforward wiki-like software and get a little fancier. But for now, that's what's there.
Yeah, and it will presumably also be a place where we can directly compare simulations themselves, like simulations that are, you know, with soft gravity, without soft gravity, magnetic fields, etc. Instead of having to look through various papers, you can come to this website and have a...
Wait, is the chart still on there? It's been a while.
Yeah, that's right. Let's see.
Would you guys be willing to actually insert the last 5 years literature or so to proactively collect those numerical experiments, and not necessarily going and poke at the simulator to see if they collaborate, but at least on your side to collect
those. Yeah, that was actually, but then we did. This isn't the table that I meant.
Okay.
That one actually Naomi posted. I didn't. I think I edited it. Yeah. She originally posted it.
I don't know if it's there. It would be try under files. I haven't looked at this in a few weeks.
Sorry. Summary of simulations?
That's actually kind of a weird Excel.
I'm not sure if I'll be able to. I don't have Excel, so it doesn't look like I'll be able to open it.
I think just open the whole proposal from last year, the one that's this Friday, 17 November. So this was a snapshot a year ago of some stuff in the literature. So there's your little list of features there. And so a way to more systematically populate this table from what it is that people offer would be great. But those of you who are listed here can tell us whether you even listed the things in the right way. But there's a little code at the bottom that tells you what those colors mean, but green clearly means yes, and I think yellow means sort of, and then the writing in the box is why sort of.
I think this is going to be useful.
Right, so this is something, Ken, where we could actually make a form that was data that people entered in addition to the free text description of what they did. And then it could wind up in a table like this.
I like this for Canada too, yeah.
For Canada too.
Because, I mean, the whole effort, when you would have too much data, the real effort will be to make it visible, you know, at once. So there's a table format that is.
But there's the answer to part of your question, Neil. So you see that light blue column, right? And it says to what scale do the people doing the simulation claim it applies?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so kind of most of them, you'll see there's a parsec to, you know, tens of parsecs. And then there's a few that we put up there that were bigger.
So Alyssa, is there any effort to, I don't know whether any of these codes replicate what another code does, but is there any attempt to offer a blind test for the two codes? You saw the clump line and
Integrand. No, well, I mean, the interesting question is for Paolo here, because there's going to be, what is it, week after next or something?
Yeah, so we've just announced a few days ago. A code comparison thing, like not too different from what they did in Santa Barbara a few years ago with cosmology, although this is less ambitious perhaps, where people with maybe 10, 20 different codes are going to try to solve the same problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's essentially one dynamical time of a turbulent simulation from an evolved initial condition that is the same for everybody, and they just run for a dynamical time and compute all sorts of statistics.
Mm-hmm.
And we then repeat the exercise with subgravity as well, and with sync particles. And then it's going to be a little bit more messy because everybody has different implementation of sync particles. But anyway, so we do have a test comparison thing that's starting right now. And we meet in 3 weeks. We'll have like 3-day meeting to discuss the results of these, and then we'll possibly cook a paper all together.
And then we'll be able to use the output of that to see which of these tests do the best to separate it. Because Paolo and I worked together several years ago on this spectral correlation function that Eric was involved with also. And we found the last paper Paolo wrote about that showed that that his simulations overlapped in spectral properties with the observations, but that the observations went to a much higher Mach number than the simulations could get to at that point. And so those were simulations in the case of his and then others that had been shown by things like just what's the histogram of line widths or what's the skewness in the spectra or something like that had been shown to exactly match observations. But the trick that we did was to measure essentially the similarity of the spectra as a function of scale and position in relation to each other. And then the simulation started to fail. And so part of the quote-unquote comparison is how stringent you are about what it is that you're measuring. And so that's really the point of this project, is to find tests that are sharp tools.
But in our case, it's more driven, this comparison is more driven at comparing codes.
Right.
And so these are numerical experiments, they're not really simulations, so I'm not sure they're the best simulation you would want to compare with the observations.
No, I was talking about to compare them with each other.
Yeah, oh, with each other, yes. But I mean, later on, this could drive a similar exercise where we all do the same, but for something that is more of a simulation, that we can really compare with the observations. So we have 20 codes doing the same, but this time it's a real simulation that we can, all of which can be compared with an observational data set, so we can repeat the exercise for something more realistic.
What do you do if the codes get different results?
Say it again?
What do you do when the codes get different results?
Declare victory.
Well, you use the website to talk about it.
you're trying to figure out why and see what's going wrong.
You design a different experiment to understand what happened.
Yeah, I mean, there was a recent comparison like this between grid and SPH-based codes looking at the problem of tidal stripping. And, you know, a bunch of different codes did it, and something very interesting came out of it, which is that it turns out that you basically can't represent Kelvin Helmholtz instabilities using SPH. You know, we didn't know that before. That's interesting.
So you find what's wrong if you answer the question there.
What if you, as an observer, take an observation, let's say a 13 CO map, and you go to this site, and you find Paolo's recent simulation, which has then been put through ready to transfer and modeled so that you can see what it would look like with the same resolution that you have and so on. And you find that the two maps don't match very well. I mean, that's likely to be the case almost always, right?
Yeah.
Then, in a statistical sense, you mean, or don't match visually?
Well, however, whatever your criteria, it's not a perfect match. It's never going to be a perfect match.
Right, no. It's not supposed to be. I mean, part of the goal
Go ahead. Do you then say, okay, well, I guess I should try comparing it to Mark's code, Mark's simulation of the same problem? Or is the response, Paolo then comes and changes one parameter and reruns his model until it matches better?
Paolo won't have time.
What is the process,
right,
when you make a comparison, after you make a comparison?
That's a good question. But I was going to say that the hope is that some people, and you guys have done some of this, and Shantan and Basu has done a lot of it, will make a choice of whether to spend their compute cycles on doing bigger simulations or on doing similar simulations with different parameters. And so the hope is that if you do have similar simulations with different parameters, you can say which ones look more like the observation. So you're right that there's never going to be a perfect match. But yes, ultimately you do need to, the whole idea is to be able to change the physics of the simulation so that you can understand.
But I think the problem with what you asked is that you didn't have a goal, okay? So if you don't have a goal, it's not very interesting to do it. It sounds like you didn't know why you were doing it. So normally we would have a goal. For example, the question a lot of us are interested in is the Mimonetic field strong or weak, or what is it? So if you had a goal in that case, you probably would have had to compare two simulations, one with a strong magnetic field and another one with a weak magnetic field. And it wouldn't matter so much if it is my simulation or Mark's simulation, better if you have both. And then you will be trying to do several statistical tests to compare with the observations and trying to figure which one does better than the other. And then you go on from there. And then when you have a real scientific question hereafter, you will know what to do a little better. And also the simulator will be a little bit more interested in joining the effort and trying to collaborate in doing this, because there is an important scientific question behind what you're doing.
Okay, so suppose my goal is, suppose I have a simulation and I'm going to try and compare it to observations. I do so and it doesn't quite match. Is it practical for me, as a simulator with a very large code, to rerun it 100 times with different parameter choices, so as to improve the match?
Not necessarily 100, but I mean,
care about 100.
Well, I can give you a real example. That there's a project that Stella Offner is leading on that we're almost ready to submit a paper on, in which we've actually done that. So we've done simulations of self-gravitating turbulence with both driven and decaying turbulence, and we're comparing and where, so we form a bunch of cores and stars and cores in these simulations, and we've then taken the complete data and some similar surveys that Philippe André has done, that Helen Kirk has done, and where they found a bunch of cores, gotten spectra, measured a bunch of properties, and we're actually comparing the two simulation cases to the observations. And not surprisingly, we don't get any perfect matches. Neither simulation completely gets it. But we actually can extract useful scientific information about, the ways in which they go wrong. And now we can sort of go in the future, we'll say, this didn't quite match because we think, for example, we didn't include protostellar outflows, and so our stars were too massive, and therefore the inflow velocities onto them were too large. So in the future, we'll try and do a simulation in which we put in protostellar outflows, and we'll see if it matches better.
You're trying to put in radiative transfer in the tracers, if you will, to enable comparison with observations, which is certainly essential. But it seems to me, and this, I don't know whether this is in your bailiwick, but since Paolo and Mark are here, it seems to me actually a much more or equally critical point is actually the radiative transfer in the UV, which really determines the abundance profiles of the tracers that you're looking at.
In
the ultraviolet, the photo dissociation and self-shielding of the species, because that makes a huge difference in what kind of line profiles you're going to get, depending on what the abundances are. And the increasing suggestions are that, the physics of the gas can only be traced through some observation, and that requires having as much confidence that the abundance where as well as you know what the mass distribution is. And I've noticed that people simulating even what should be the most simple of these, namely the H atomic to molecular transition, simply don't want to treat this issue. They make dramatic approximations and neglect this critical self-shielding problem, which I think could have a big effect on what you're going to observe. So if you're going to do radiative transfer, I'd actually start with it. Forget the millimeter till later. I'm confident that you can predict the abundance.
Yeah, but you're saying that the problem is not really the transfer. The problem is you build the transfer because you want us to do the chemistry, and the chemistry has to be done online. So I totally agree with you. And in fact, that's precisely my reaction, because I worked for some years on doing the transfer, and I'm aware that the main uncertainty is the chemistry. And so I'm pretty serious in getting involved into doing heavy duty 3D, online chemistry with the radiative transfer you're talking about, then we know that that's really the next step. It's unavoidable.
Right, and we have to distinguish between the sort of post hoc radiative transfer, which is all we're doing, right? Yeah, and right. Then the built-in self-consistent kind of radiative transfer and simulation, which is totally not my job here.
Nowadays, I think there really is a danger that you can get people heading up a very misleading alley started doing many adjusting parameters to adjust the physics, if you will, the driving of the turbulence, and not treated the chemistry at all. So I'm encouraging people to back off and say maybe we have to spend our time.
You'll notice that there's a column there that says chemistry.
Yeah, it's pretty empty.
The only thing that's entirely right. We put the column there. Yeah. We acknowledge this as a problem.
Well, you have to. So you have to distinguish between sort of two types of chemistry. There's the chemistry that it's okay to do in post-process, and the chemistry that it isn't. So
I can't think of any of the left of that.
What, that it's okay to do in post-process? The chemistry of ammonia formation, because it's not going to affect the dynamics. It's certainly an important problem, and if you want to know what things look like, that's fine, but it's a waste of CPU cycles to do that as part of your simulation. What you want to do is do the simulation, and then figure out, given the density...
Some of the key chemistry determines the cooling.
No, there are certainly examples of that. What I'm pointing out is that...
You're saying not ammonia.
Yeah, like not ammonia. So ammonia is very important, or if I want to do, a comparison to observations in ammonia, it's not at all important for the dynamics.
I actually disagree, because the problem is not that you want to do it online because it affects dynamics. You want to do it online because the turbulent diffusion turbulent mixing will affect the abundances quite a bit. I mean, we know that the chemistry is out of equilibrium, and a lot of that is because of the turbulence. So if you don't do it online, you don't catch it.
Well, depends on how often you're doing your data dumps.
Not all the chemistry.
Yeah, I mean, the point is, this is a sort of a question that has to be asked species by species, whether it's important to do this online or not. Because
I would certainly agree, even the most restricted network online is a big improvement
But it's also a big increase in computational cost.
Alas,
but it's going to happen, so don't worry.
I think there has to be a sense of what, the physics can get arbitrarily complicated here, but at some zero, there should be a target. What's our zeroth order thing that we can achieve with the codes that we sort of have now? It'll take huge amounts of work to put amplifold diffusion chemistry, et cetera, but at the level of the codes now, which can do MHD, self-gravity, and some decent cooling, what kind of problems can we tackle, and how well will those correspond to, an observational standard before you then cut down the next level? If all the simulations have failed at the first level, then I guess we have something to worry about. But
most of the simulations are between 1 and 10 parsec, if you see there, which is the best scale to not have to worry too much about depletion chemistry on the low density side or the high density side. So
in other words, it has to be sort of a graded set of calculations. No one's going to hang around forever doing the simulations thinking that we have to wait until we have all these things in before we've learned something. But at the same time, I guess that's the purpose of this exercise, to understand what can we check off as a box as having been achieved. Anything? I missed the first part of your discussion.
I was trying to give Paolo some credit for when he wrote this SCF paper a few years ago, where he looked at his own simulations in the context of the observations. Some of them with the lower Mach number actually did capture.
Yeah, I would think that there, at some beginning level to this long journey, we must have succeeded.
I think so, or I don't think we will.
But I don't know how to quantify that.
Well, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah,
but we should let Phil get this talk, I think. I don't know. Go ahead, Neil, what were you going to say?
No, I think it's a very nice effort. I think one has to be careful with it in the sense that observers will naively grab some simulation, observe it, and say, this does or doesn't look like my data without looking carefully at what that simulation was trying to do. For example, Mark's, the one that we looked at where they were doing the Spondee-Rail experiment, that really shouldn't be compared to any observations that I can think of.
Maybe we should put a little colored box.
No, I completely agree. That was totally a numerical experiment that, you know, was answering a pure physics problem,
right,
not a simulation.
Maybe
you grabbed that experiment.
Yeah, we should have another column that says, like,
don't
okay to
this.
Compare this with data and just an experiment. Rahul's going to make an updated version of this
table.
And
about ready to taste.
For 5 years.
Yeah.
Not ready,
ready to taste. Finish cooking. No, edible, not edible, I guess.
Poisonous.
Okay, that's enough with the food.